Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Chunker. It's Friday, July 12th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. Good morning, Ethan.
Morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and we'll chat with WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Ethan, Mashpee Commons has been looking to expand for some time, but hasn't been able to come to an agreement with the town on what the new development might look like. There's word now that the developers are taking a new approach by bringing in the Cape Cod Commission.
Yeah, so I mean, for over a year now, the Mashpee Commons, which if people don't know, is that very big kind of village-esque development
shopping center yeah.
Down over by the Mashpee Rotary. So they've been in talks, the Mashpee Commons, with the Mashpee Planning Board for about a year now, and things haven't really gone very far.
So because they're looking to expand in a big way.
Yeah, yes. They definitely have big plans, and the planning board is a little hesitant to approve what they're doing. So there's this kind of new trilateral. We don't get to use that word very often. So it's the Cape Cod Commission, which, again, if people don't know, is this kind of big overarching governmental agency for the county. They get involved a lot if a project is very large, or if it kind of starts spanning across a couple towns, they get involved and kind of add a little extra oversight. So it seems like they're all kind of coming together, and they're going to be going together for this expansion, kind of working out how exactly all this is going to work.
And one of the interesting wrinkles here is that the former longtime executive director of the Cape Cod Commission, Paul Nidzwicki, is actually working with Mashpee Commons in bringing this discussion to the Cape Cod Commission. And it sounds like that's adding, for many people, that's adding a new sense that these are really credible discussions. He brings with him a lot of credibility.
Yeah, I mean, talk about a guy who knows the ins and outs of the commission and how things work. He was kind of in between jobs from the commission, and I think he's at Cape Cod Healthcare now.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of picked up this, and so he's kind of saying, I'm going to finish this out. Mashpee and the Mashpee Commons have been kind of going back and forth on this. I believe this is the first time that there's ever been this kind of three-party agreement. So it should be interesting to see how this kind of works out. I mean, this agreement, the idea is it's going to be a contract is going to be entered between the town, the Commons, and the Commission to kind of lay out what regulations would apply to the development and kind of what conditions would be set on it.
Part of this proposal is incorporating residential and commercial development as they try to expand at Mashpee Commons. And on the roundup here in the past, we've talked about the discussions that the developers were having with the town of Mashpee, and they were relatively contentious discussions for a while there about how to push this development forward and what kinds of impacts it would have on the town and how the town's permitting and zoning was going to try to manage this process.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about Mashpee Commons, there's nothing else like that in Mashpee. Yes. So zoning is kind of thrown out the window when you have this one very singular type of thing. So it's hard to kind of have these overarching rules for the whole town plus this one spot. And I think this agreement, there's thoughts that the first agreement for Mashpee Commons was made in 1986. So there is this kind of way to kind of look back at that and kind of update it and see what kind of broader issues can be looked at in this whole scheme.
And Mashpee, the town of Mashpee itself has signed on to this and sounds like they feel like this is a constructive way to move this conversation forward after this sort of more than a year of not being able to get this to go forward.
Yeah, there's been a few different attempts to do different types of zoning and form-based codes.
Yes.
That's another phrase you don't hear very often. Yeah. It's these kind of things. A lot of things have been tried and nothing's really gained much traction. So I think a lot of people are confident that this could be the best way forward.
Let me ask you about another story. The state's highest court is looking at a case that has to do with the constitutionality of license plate readers on the Cape bridges. And this is an issue without precedent, apparently.
Yeah, so the Supreme Judicial Court, the SJC, the highest court in the Massachusetts land, is taking up this license plate reader question on the bridges, the Sagamore and the Bourne.
Now, I think most people coming over those bridges, driving over those bridges, have no idea that their license plates are being recorded and entered into a database.
Yeah,
somewhere.
The state police say hello. every time you go over that bridge, both of those bridges, there is a record of that. And so this was where this all kind of started. Yeah. There was Jason McCarthy. He was brought up on drug charges, and data from those cameras was used to support that charge. His attorney saying, hey, that shouldn't be allowed. You shouldn't be using this against my client. A Superior Court judge here in Barnstable County said, you can use that. His kind of point of view was, it's only tracking you in this one place.
Mm-hmm.
It only this one reading. So there's not this, I think he's called it the looming specter.
The looming specter of surveillance.
Yeah,
yes.
So it's not like Big Brother is following you all around. Mm-hmm. In the judge's point of view.
In the judge's point of view, yeah.
So he was saying it can be. There are the defendant is attorney is arguing that this should be treated more like cell data. You should need to get a warrant for this if you want to use it in a case. Especially if it adds up to a certain amount of time. But basically, so the SJC is asking for, they're called amicus briefs. So basically, interested parties. In this case, I believe the ACLU and a few others have said they're planning to weigh in. They can kind of give their thoughts on the matter and kind of how these license plate readers should be used. And it's important to note that anytime the SJC looks at anything, it could be a very own error decision on this particular case, this singular, very singular thing, or they could create this whole massive decision on how license plate readers across the state is used. So this could be it's not the usual bridge stories we write, but
yeah.
it could be a huge deal going forward.
And the SJC kind of pointing out that this is new technology. It hasn't really been regulated, or they've certainly never seen a case that looked at this before. So this is new, and that's why they're asking for these amicus briefs. And trying to get a handle on this discussion going forward, they might even push it back to the legislature and lean on the legislature a little bit and ask them to try to come up with some regulations around license plate camera readers.
Yeah, when anything gets sent up there, you never know what can happen, what can come out. It's wild things going on. Maybe
let's stay with the bridges here. A group has been formed to advocate for and really push for their replacement. You've covered this story for The Times. Talk a little bit about this group and where we're at with the bridges right now.
So the bridges are both more than 80 years old. I think they're pushing 83 to 85 at this point. So if you think about it, a bridge made in the 1930s, a lot of people have issue with the lane size.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're 2 feet below what modern bridge standards are in width. And these two bridges are frequently have to be more major rehabilitation.
For folks who are only here during the summer, they might not know that, like, in the spring, those bridges, the Bourne Bridge was closed for down to one lane for a big portion of this, one lane in each direction for a big portion of the spring, and the Sagamore the year before that.
Yeah, and they're saying 2025 is when that's going to happen again.
And all that is for repairs and maintenance just to keep these bridges operational.
Yeah, just to keep it at standard level. So, yeah, there's this group called the Coalition of the Fix, which is a group of the Cape. It's really being pushed by the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce and the Cape Cod Canal Region Chamber of Commerce. But there's other organizations like the Association of Realtors and other people involved. They kind of created this coalition to really keep the bridges in the forefront of everybody's mind and kind of the long-term fixes for them. They kind of all gathered around in Buzzards Bay at the park there on Monday and kind of really kind of continue to try and hit home that they really want these bridges replaced.
And they're saying that this isn't necessarily about bringing more cars onto the Cape. This isn't necessarily about more traffic. This is an issue of almost the long-term economic viability of the whole region, that these bridges have to be to size and you have to be reliable.
Yeah, so the State Department of Transportation recently came out with a study that had a recommendation for a bridge that was a lot bigger, more lanes, I think it was three a side, and that brought some worries from people as you're just going to inundate the Cape with traffic. It's going to become even worse. You're not going to be able to get from your town to another town at all. They're saying, like you said there, this is a way to keep status quo and keep us alive. So it should be that. I mean, so the Department of Transportation is looking at this. They've made recommendations to changes not only for the bridges but at the roadways leading up to
the bridges. That's the state, but the bridges themselves are actually are federal.
Yeah, exactly. So the DOT's recommendations are just that. They're recommendations. Yeah. These bridges are owned and operated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
And any replacement will be paid for by the federal government.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there are two bills kind of just starting off in the federal government right now. There is one that would designate money to federal evacuation routes, but again, there's no promise that that would come to us. And then there is also money that is, I'm told by our Rep Keating, William Keating, down here on the Cape, that the way this bill is worded, the only two bridges that would qualify for design money, it's $5 million in design money, would be our two Cape bridges, the automobile bridges. So that is kind of a lot more firm and hard numbers, $5 million for designing two new bridges. But that's still a long way from
coming up with the money to build them.
We've been told that a price tag would be around $1 billion for two new bridges.
$1 billion. You have an interesting story out of Provincetown this week. Some art gallery owners there are asking the town to put tighter restrictions on who can sell art and how.
Yeah, so this man, Ray Wiggs, who owns the Ray Wiggs Gallery in Provincetown down the East End, for people who aren't super familiar with Provincetown, there is a whole gallery district in Provincetown. The East End of Commercial Street, there's galleries galore. He's wanting the town to kind of step up and kind of shield galleries a little more. His point of view is there's more restaurants, bars, and inns kind of getting into what galleries do, selling art, holding openings for artists. And his fear, he told me his concern, he didn't like worried. His concern was if there's a finite amount of money being spent on art in Provincetown, and if enough is siphoned away from the art galleries, it can hurt the art galleries, which are kind of the purveyors, the people who really know art are the art gallery owners. Maybe not as much a bar or restaurant may not know as much about art. So he worries that if enough money is siphoned off to these other types of people who are selling art, it could hurt the gallery scene overall and then could water down kind of Provincetown's art scene in general.
And really saying that the gallery system is more than just selling art. It's about developing art and the relationships between artists and the people who come to town to buy it and bringing on new artists, and that the galleries know how to do this. And if Provincetown wants to be an art town and continue to be that kind of an art town, it needs to be protecting its galleries a little bit more, perhaps. And then you can see on the other side the potential people saying to shut out artists from entering this system.
Yeah, there was a few people who were worried that who's to say that who can sell art, and kind of these kind of really emerging artists just getting started, they can't get their art into a gallery. They're not good enough, for lack of a better term. So this is their way to kind of really get their start. It's like if you're a cover band.
Or they might not have the connections. Yeah,
you could be a cover band at a bar. You're not going to play at Rockefeller Center or something like that. But, and so he was going to the licensing board and saying galleries should be galleries. These other places, which they don't depend solely on art sales to live. If they sell a few paintings, good for them. If not, they're running a bar. So he's saying you kind of should be a license for a gallery should be a gallery, but then it kind of gets into sticky questions about who determines what's a gallery and what's fine art, these kind of questions that are open in this can of worms.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times has been Ethan Genter. Ethan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve.
We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us on the phone right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is Brian Dowd. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Steve.
Brian, there was a bomb scare at the Island Airport this week. It shut down the airport for more than 3 hours Tuesday morning. You have a little bit of information about the suspect in that case for us?
Yeah, so Tuesday morning early, there was a bomb threat at the Martha's Vineyard Airport. And Julie Tejada, a 31-year-old woman from East Boston, is being investigated for actually a number of bomb threats made to American airports on Tuesday. Police have her, and she's also being charged with a stabbing of a Boston EMT on Thursday. And when police went to investigate Tejada for the bomb scare, they said that she didn't exhibit any signs or terroristic intentions. But they have her in custody now, and
there's not a whole lot of information yet out about all of this, but it doesn't sound like there was any terrorist connection at all or anything like that.
Correct. Yeah, it's still under investigation, and that's about all the information they have at this point.
Brian, the strike by Vineyard Transit Authority bus drivers continues, and these are the year-round drivers, the full-time drivers. We're 2 weeks in now and maybe a little bit more. Can you tell us where things stand?
Yeah, so there was kind of a lot of news on that front. The VTA drivers, yeah, are still on strike. It's been a little bit more than 2 weeks now. And they've been getting a lot of support from the community. And even State Representative Dylan Fernandez came down last week to meet with the drivers. He came and walked up to the steamship and bought them pizza for lunch and was just saying how important unions are to the island, especially. And but the fallout from the driver striking is that some of the services that the VTA normally offers have become unavailable, such as the Medivan service, which is it's kind of a special service that the VTA offers every Tuesday year round for seniors and people with disabilities. It'll pick them up from the island and get them on the boat, and then bring them to medical appointments on the Cape, and especially in Boston, because a lot of people go to Mass General. And that service has actually been canceled because of the strike. The woman who usually drives the Medivan, she's one of the drivers on strike, so they haven't had anyone able to fill that position. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a lot of seniors on the island it's affected a lot of them. Jean Cargill was one of them. She's a senior who resides at Woodside Village here. And she made her appointment back in January, and it was supposed to be last Tuesday that she was going to go off. And, you know, she called the night before, and they told her that it wasn't available. And so she had to scramble a bit and figure out what to do.
And the strike itself, where are we at with that? Does there appear to be any movement at all between the two sides?
No, they're still trying to figure out when to talk to continue negotiations. But it's still kind of at a standstill at this moment.
Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
We're going to speak right now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, a recent study looks at potential changes along Chatham's coast, and this is a far-ranging look with predictions all the way out to 2045. This has to do with shifting sands and erosion, and it's a fascinating picture. Tell us about this.
It's really fascinating. As we know, Chatham's eastern shoreline is very dynamic ever since the 1987 break in North Beach. The beaches in that area have been shifting around, causing significant damage both to the shore and to shorefront homes. 9 houses were lost after that 1987 break. In more recent times, the changes to the 2 inlets in the harbor are caused even more uncertainty about what the future was going to hold, sort of in a microcosm. And so the town embarked on a $250,000 study to develop a long-range coastal resiliency plan. And this was conducted by Applied Coastal Research and Engineering and the Center for Coastal Studies. And the recently released report has kind of both good and bad news. Now, basically, the patterns are conforming to the 100 to 150-year cycle of the barrier beach, the outer beach here, which was described by Graham Geis and others, 30, 40 years ago. So, but this study really zoned in on specific areas and how the changes to the barrier beach were going to affect the inner shoreline. Areas around Minister's Point, which are in the north, sort of opposite the north inlet. If you might remember, a revetment failed there during a coastal storm in 2017. And the report says that area will continue to see strong currents and potentially damaging waves for a number of years to come. It'll become more open to the ocean. Just to the south, however, the shoreline will benefit as what is now North Beach Island continues to break up and move, migrate really to the west. All the sand there is going to move towards the mainland. And so that sand will protect a lot of those shoreline areas and some of the homes there. To the south of that, when you get towards the Lighthouse Beach area, a lot of that shoreline is already protected by revetments because it was hammered after the 1987 break. But probably the most problematic area here is going to be the Little Beach and Outermost Harbor neighborhoods, which are south of the lighthouse. And we've seen significant storm inundation there in recent years. Mm-hmm. And the report says that's going to continue. And scientists who authored the report had a number of recommendations to try to protect those low-lying homes mm-hmm. in that area. Now, they range from building up the shorefront dune there to 9 feet or higher, and raising the bulkhead around the Outermost Harbor Marine, which is kind of a vulnerable point for storm surges, all the way to constructing what amounts to basically an inland dike, which would be almost like a levee system, which would not only protect those homes there, but also Morris Island Road, which is the only access to houses on Morris and Stage Islands. Now, scientists have said that by 2045, some of that sand from North Beach Island could be moving south to protect the Little Beach area. But in the meantime, town officials and homeowners there have already started working on plans to fortify the dunes. Mm-hmm. And they're going to use this this new plan, which also, in fact, takes into account climate change, by the way. They're going to be using this plan as they move forward with those protective efforts. And the if you're a mariner or a fisherman mm-hmm. or a boater, the really bad news is that sand is going to be clogging the navigation harbors in Chatham really as far out as the study goes. So that kind of gives some mm-hmm. new urgency to the town's investigation of purchasing a dredge itself or working with nearby communities to acquire a dredge.
You've got some nice graphic layouts of all of this, too, on the website in the paper. Take a look at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim Wood, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm going to speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, a lot of legal action ongoing now in Nantucket news, it seems like. Let's start with the proposed Surfside Crossing 40B housing development. Both sides are appealing this zoning board decision. Is that right?
They are. That was a zoning board decision that came down last month on the Surfside Crossing 40B housing development. The developers of that housing project, who initially sought to build 156 homes and condominiums on 13 acres off South Shore Road, have appealed the ZBA approval of 60 units on that property. And they're going to take that appeal to the State Housing Appeals Committee. Some other people, including the Nantucket Land Council, have also appealed that ZBA decision, and they're going to take their appeals to Superior Court. They have to wait, though, until the developers have their day at the Housing Appeals Committee before the Superior Court proceedings can start. according to the developer's appeal that they filed last week, the ZBA decision is not economically viable for them. It effectively constitutes a denial, impermissibly redesigned the project, and imposes conditions beyond the authority. 40B, as most people in these parts know, is the state law that allows developers to circumvent local zoning, build more densely populated developments than normally allowed in exchange for providing affordable housing. And this particular property that they're looking at was in 2-acre zoning on Nantucket. So it could have had about 13 houses, 26 perhaps, with secondary dwellings on them. But the ZBA approval was for 60. That is why the opponents, including a group called Nantucket Tipping Point, have appealed. They say that is still too dense. They have concerns about traffic, about water quality, about sewer capacity in that area, not to mention the quality of life for the residents in that neighborhood. So the Housing Appeals Committee proceedings will come first. There's not been a date set yet for that, and the Superior Court will come after that, whenever that may happen.
Some erosion control issues for the Sankatee Bluffs also heading to court. Tell us about that.
They are. Superior Court is going to be quite busy with Nantucket items in the next few months or year or so. The Sconset Beach Preservation Fund has appealed to both the state DEP and Superior Court the Conservation Commission's decision to deny the expansion of its erosion control project on the Sankatee Bluff. The CONCOM voted 4-2 last month to deny a 3,000-foot expansion to the north and south of the geotextile tubing that is protecting the base of the bluff now. Commissioners expressed concern that the expansion there would have a negative environmental impact on the bluff and the beach below it, as well as the sea life and the land animals that inhabit the bluff, and could potentially accelerate erosion along the ends of the project. But project proponents say the expansion is necessary to protect the houses and the summer homes along Baxter Road at the top of the bluff. Several of those homes actually have already been moved back. A couple have had to have been demolished over the last decade or so due to the erosion in that neck of the woods. And they say that the geotextile tubing that's there now is not exacerbating erosion. It's actually working. The tubes are protecting against erosion, and the sand they're adding on top of those tubes has kept things stable for the last 3 years or so.
Josh, we don't have time to get into the Kevin Spacey, but that's more legal stuff happening there in Nantucket. I encourage folks to go to the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror to take a look at that, the Kevin Spacey trial that's been ongoing out there as well. Josh Bolling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And now we're going to speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Ed, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, a presidential candidate came to Provincetown. In fact, for a day, it was Pete Town. Tell us about this.
Yes, it was Mayor Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana, who did a swing last weekend through Provincetown, Nantucket, and Martha's Vineyard on what has obviously been a real fundraising sweep for him. Of course, there have been a lot of reports about how he has outraised all of the other Democratic presidential candidates in the last quarter. I think he raised $24.8 million. And he came to Provincetown last Friday with his husband, Chasten. And, of course, as the only openly gay candidate in the field of 23 in the Democratic Party, he generated a huge amount of excitement on the Cape and in Provincetown. And they had announced a public event at Provincetown Town Hall. The tickets, you had to have a ticket. They were free, and they were all gone in about 20 minutes. So he had a capacity crowd of over 700 people there. It was a very happy group of people who gave the couple a extremely warm, enthusiastic welcome. They started the day with breakfast at Liz's Cafe and then walked down Commercial Street greeting people. And Casey Myers and I were able to have a private meeting with the candidate before his rally. And In both cases, in our interview with him and in his meeting with the people, he really emphasized how much he loved Provincetown and how he saw it as a kind of model for America of openness and welcoming to everyone, no matter who you are.
It sounded like you almost couldn't ask for a warmer welcome for a candidate than he received.
Yeah, well, the circumstances were particularly auspicious, I think, because there's a summer camp in Provincetown called Camp Lightbulb for LGBTQ youth. And they were there last week, and they had actually reserved Town Hall for that Friday night for their annual talent show. But the Buttigieg campaign got in touch with them and asked if they could have the Town Hall for a couple of hours, and the camp said, of course. So all 35 of these campers, teenagers from age 14 to 18 from all over the country, who spend a week in Provincetown and just soaking up the culture and the warmth of the place. They were all there, and Buttigieg introduced them to the crowd, and it was the kids got just a thunderous ovation. And I think that set the tone for the whole event. And in fact, mm-hmm. he addressed the kids in his speech and said, you know, everybody's going to be telling you you're the future, but my message to you is you are the present, and your voices are really important right now in mm-hmm. raising some of the important issues about mm-hmm. Civil rights and gun violence and climate change, and these are the most critical issues. And he told a story about how in South Bend, where he's the mayor.
Ed, we're going to have to I'm sorry to jump in, but we're going to have to.
That's okay.
We're going to have to leave it there. There's nice coverage there in the Provincetown Banner of Mayor Pete's visit to P-Town. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you, Steve.
And now Noah Asimow from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us. Good morning, Noah.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. And with me in the studio now is WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And we are going to be talking about the offshore wind company Vineyard Wind, which had a couple of setbacks this week. Noah, start us off. The Edgartown Conservation Commission made news this week with its decision against the offshore wind company. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, so this was kind of a stunner. Basically, what happened was 2 weeks ago. Well, so I'll just start by saying the Edgartown Conservation Commission, they have jurisdiction over these cables because a small portion of them will run 1 mile east of Chappaquiddick, so that's Edgartown waters. But 2 weeks ago, they had a public hearing on the project, and up until now, the cables have pretty much sailed through every other regional regulatory body, and that includes, you know, the Cape Cod Commission, the Barnstable Commission, the Nantucket Conservation Commission, and even the Martha's Vineyard Commission. But here, a bunch of fishermen showed up to voice their concerns about the project, and during this five-hour public hearing, they sort of laid them all out for the Conservation Commission. They said, you know, we don't know. There are a lot of unknowns about the project.
How long was the public hearing? Did you just say 5 hours?
It was 5 hours. It started at about 10 a.m. and went until probably 3 in the afternoon. Totally unusual. This is like the Edgartown Conservation Commission is, no offense to the Edgartown Conservation Commission, but they're normally a quieter regulatory body. Especially in comparison to things like the Martha's Vineyard Commission. So to have them have a five-hour public hearing was just kind of shocking to begin with. But then the number of fishermen who came to speak against the project was surprising, too. You know, these guys just basically said, these are the waters that we rely on for our livelihood, and we don't know what kind of effect this project's going to have. And, of course, the Vineyard Wind representatives were saying that there's been an environmental statement that came out, a draft one, that says the effects are going to be minor, that this project has been permitted by these other bodies, but for the commission, it didn't seem to matter.
Let me bring in Sarah Mises-Tan here. Sarah, you've been covering Vineyard Wind for the past year or more. The company also saw a setback on the federal level this week. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so Vineyard Wind has basically a number of permits and approvals that they need to receive from various different state and federal agencies like the Edgartown Commission and also from the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, kind of two ends of the spectrum, from very small agencies to very large agencies. But essentially, they need all of those to approve their project before they can go ahead and start construction. They had at the end of this week, so today, that federal approval from BOEM. It was due, but BOEM announced that they were actually going to delay that release of the final environmental impact statement.
They did not say, we don't know how long it's going to be delayed. Is that right?
Yeah, no, it's been delayed indefinitely. And the company has been keeping a pretty quick timeline for this project so far. They've been saying all along that they are aiming to break ground on their offshore wind farm by the end of this year. And so who knows, a setback like this where BOEM has not said we're going to release that final environmental impact survey next week, not this week. They haven't really given any sort of timeline. It could set the project back for sure.
And what is the company saying?
Vineyard Wind released a very brief statement. Seems like off the record. Everyone seems very calm. They say that they don't think that this is actually going to change their timeline. On the website, they say changes and setbacks like this are anticipated given that they've been leading the charge in the offshore wind industry.
Noah, I saw comments on your website about the Edgartown Conservation Commission's decision. What's the feeling on the Vineyard about what this, how this came down?
It's very mixed. I think the issue is controversial. At the meeting, there weren't just fishermen to speak against the project. There were, you know, probably the same number, if not more, members or you know, islanders who were saying we are, you know, 10 miles out here in the middle of the Atlantic. Climate change affects us. We need to start doing things that promote renewable energy, and that this is the kind of the only way that we're going to have a sustainable future. And wind projects like this are, you know, that step forward. So I think that there's really a mix. I think the fishermen see it as a win, but what's going to end up happening is, my guess, Vineyard Wind is going to appeal the project, and it's going to go to the Mass DEP. And then ultimately they are going to make a decision. And then the Conservation Commission, I guess, can come back and they could take them to court over it, but that's a long time in the future and would be hard to speculate. So I think that there are kind of mixed feelings here. There's been a lot of advocacy on the island for this project. Mm-hmm. You know, there are jobs that are going to be added because of it. Vineyard Wind's been working with the high school here. And those issues all came into play, but I guess the Conservation Commission saw it as its purview to say, no, we can't approve something when there are, I guess, for them, many unknowns.
Hey, Noah, I think I misidentified you on your introduction. You are, of course, Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah,
yes.
thanks for joining us this morning. I apologize for that.
I appreciate it. No problem, Steve.
And Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI. And Sarah, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to check in with news from the State House. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point, and we are discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to update you now with action up at the State House in Boston. We're heading into the middle of July, several weeks into the new fiscal year, and Massachusetts still has no budget. WCAI's Catherine Ident talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean about this and other issues happening on Beacon Hill.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Last time we spoke, Mike, the legislature was a day or two into this whole not having a budget thing. So here we are. I almost feel like it's Groundhog Day. We're talking about this a lot. So give us an update. Has anything moved? Are we closer to getting a budget?
Nah, no. they might be. Here's the thing about the budget negotiations is it's between the House and the Senate. So you never quite know what the Democrats who are in charge are going to disagree about. This is not necessarily a Democrats versus Republican thing. This is Democrats on Democrats. And there's a number of things that we can get into that they might be disagreeing on. But the thing is, I can't tell you what is holding up this budget because they negotiate this final budget plan behind closed doors. They'll tell you it's confidential negotiations. We'll tell you it's secret negotiations because they'll never say what the details were, what policy points, what spending they were, haggling over all this time. So, yeah, we're over a week late into this fiscal year that started July 1st. Now, there is a temporary budget in place for the month of July. And, if it goes on until next week or so, the legislature might have to pass another one-month budget to cover August if it comes to that. And that's when things really get dicey and folks start to look askance at the Democratic leaders and just wonder, why can't you get this kind of thing done? So, you know, I can just kind of go over what they might be haggling over.
We could do some guesswork, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is based on conversations that I've had, you know, with other people. And most importantly, it's what the big differences were going into this. You know, the House had their plan and the Senate had theirs. And what they're doing is there's six members now who are reconciling the two plans to make a budget to put on Governor Charlie Baker's desk. The biggest thing really was probably prescription drug cost controls. There were differing plans on how to rein in some spending on the state spends on prescription drugs for things like things like mass health. Aid to the nursing home industry was a big one. There were kind of differing plans to boost the ailing nursing home industry. The Senate, I think, had a little bit more than the House did, but they were both kind of competing plans. Education funding, they had kind of drastically different plans. That's short-term education funding for the year, not the long-term formula that we talk about all the time. That'll happen probably next year or later this year. And, you know, there's things like taxing opioid manufacturers and adding the tobacco tax to vape products. That's something the Senate wanted to do that the House didn't, at least right now. They didn't want to include it in the budget. So there's any number of things that they might still be at odds about, but they're not, you know, world-shattering issues. And so some folks around here are thinking, why is it taking this long? I thought this was supposed to be the boring budget. I thought you guys were already pretty much agreed. So it's starting to get a little dicey.
Does this impact anything like bond ratings for the state, or is it really just an internal thing and they can kind of take their time and do whatever they need to do?
See, that really depends on who you ask. One thing that did happen last week was that Moody's, the bond agency, they actually said that the seven states that didn't have budgets in place at the time, a couple weeks ago, were suffering from a failure of governance, I believe was how they put it. But they didn't do anything to the actual bond rating, which is still AA+, which is as high as it can possibly get, meaning that the Commonwealth has very, very good credit and can borrow against that bond rating all they want. When you bring up that claim of failure of governance with both Democrats and Republicans here, no one really bats an eyelash. I think that everyone, including the rating agencies, are much more concerned about things like the Rainy Day Fund, which is quite strong in Massachusetts now. We've built that up over the last couple fiscal years. And honestly, Democrats and Republicans, fiscal conservatives on both sides, really don't mind that this thing is late.
Switching gears just a little, House Speaker Robert DeLeo met with the heads of several committees, including the Ways and Means Committee and the Revenue Committee, to look at the idea of a transportation finance package. What happened with that meeting, and is that going to be a bill we actually talk about a little later this year?
Yeah, this one actually is becoming real. It's been in the offing for quite a while now, but finally, DeLeo brought in his team, which is, you know, at least the players on this matter, which is going to be the chairman of the Transportation Committee, William Strauss, and the chairman of the Revenue Committee, Mark Cusack from Braintree. So that's kind of like, all right, transportation, what do we need to pay for? Okay, revenue, how can we pay for it? That's, you know, in a nutshell, that's tax and spend is what that is. And I think that there's wide-ranging agreement across the aisle and across the chambers on Beacon Hill that taxes are going to need to go up in order to pay for some of the transportation infrastructure improvements that the state really needs to keep the economy going. So DeLeo did say that he wants to have a bill done by the end of this calendar year, meaning that it'll happen sometime between September when they get back from that break and the holiday break, which is, you know, mid-December.
The cell phone bill, you and I talked about this a while ago, and the idea was that a ban on using cell phones in your hand in your car would be in effect for the holiday, July 4th. We are well past that now, and that law's not in effect.
Come and gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is something, it was a Baker priority for a while. Both chambers kind of said that they would pass it, and they did, but they passed different versions of the bill. It's similar to the budget negotiations that there's a six-person committee that's now, you know, ferreting out the differences and coming up with a compromise final bill to give to Baker that would essentially say you can't have your phone in your hands. You can use hands-free, you can use headsets, you can use, you know, built-in Bluetooth in your car. I think the thinking was that a lot of newer cars have that built in, and that the technology is affordable enough that most people have access to it. So instead of, you know, fumbling around with your phone, if you got your phone in your hand, you can get pulled over. we thought that was going to be in place, like you said, for the summertime driving season, and it hasn't happened yet because the legislature has not put out that bill. And again, like that budget, secret negotiations. We don't know what the holdup is. We can speculate that it's about the data reporting, the where the House and the Senate differed. The Senate wanted to go a little bit further with what kind of traffic stop data needed to be reported back to the state, so that then the state could analyze if there's any racial bias in that stop data. But the House didn't go quite that far. That might be where they differ. But again, we don't know, and there's no final bill. Baker's getting ready to sign it, and there's nothing for him to sign.
And finally, Mike, before I let you go, I want to check in and hear about what's been going on since we learned that thousands of records at the Registry of Motor Vehicles were not being processed correctly. What have you learned this week?
It's only getting worse, really, at the RMV. So, of course, it was discovered that the RMV was not processing alerts and documents from other states, reports from other states that said this Massachusetts driver was pulled over for whatever or arrested for whatever and, you know, this kind of dangerous driving or an OUI or something like that. And they were not getting into the Massachusetts system, and then those Massachusetts licenses were not being suspended. And that was that deadly motorcycle crash in New Hampshire, which was a driver from West Springfield who should have had his license revoked because of an OUI arrest in Connecticut previously. Connecticut told Massachusetts. Massachusetts didn't process that document. The driver's license was never suspended, and seven motorcyclists died in New Hampshire. When they looked into that incident, they found that there are 52 bins of documents from other states that Massachusetts had not been processing. That has only gotten higher and higher. And now that investigation is going into what Massachusetts didn't tell other states, so that this failure may have been working both ways. Both Massachusetts didn't know what was going on in other states, and Massachusetts wasn't telling other states what was going on with their drivers. So really expect the number of suspensions to grow. And as this kind of internal audit of the RMV gets going, Baker has said that there won't be any personnel changes until that is finally finished. And that could take a few weeks. One thing that to note, though, the legislature is going to step in this month and hold oversight hearings on the RMV and kind of try to get to the bottom as much as they can as to what happened and how we got there and how it's getting fixed.
And now we have news that the American Civil Liberties Union is suing over photo IDs that the RMV has been holding and distributing as well, correct?
Mm-hmm. There's another thing. Yeah, this is kind of a bigger national story that the Washington Post reported on, that federal authorities were tapping into state driver databases, meaning that, you know, Homeland Security or immigration enforcement were accessing state DMVs, RMV in our state, and having access to photographic data and running facial recognition programs on there to aid in their federal law enforcement. And this was something that, state DMVs were consenting to, but drivers weren't. The Massachusetts RMV does not participate in a system like this. They will cooperate with federal investigators on a case-by-case basis on criminal inquiries. So the feds would request certain information about a certain suspect, and then the RMV would give them that data there. But it is not the wide-ranging access to databases that the other states have. However, the ACLU is suing because there's no law that states that they're not doing that. So the ACLU is kind of coming at the state to clear that up so that it doesn't happen.
A lot of eyes on the Registry of Motor Vehicles these days. That's Mike Dean, our State House reporter, talking to us from Beacon Hill. Thanks so much, Mike, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Great to be with you, Catherine.
And that is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests. We had with us earlier in the program Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times, Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We checked in with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette, WCAI's own Sarah Mises-Tan, and Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean there. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.